This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio, 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean County and Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.1 in Lincoln, covering much of central Illinois. We're going to talk about the abortion issue today, so that's going to be the topic, and we're going to take some excerpts and read some from a symposium that appears in First Things magazine, the October issue, and it's entitled Rome Must Fall, and there are several articles by different people in that symposium presentation, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. And it's a very important topic. It's coming up here for a ruling by the Supreme Court in December. And from what we hear, the ruling is likely, more likely than not, to result in the elimination of Roe. And we'll talk about that. So it could be something that's going to affect the whole nation, and it's going to be probably the most important topic of our day. And I think people should be aware of exactly what the issue is and what is at stake. And so that's what we'll get into today. And at any rate, we're brought to you by you. Remember that. And we depend on you for our donations. So if you can and would like to make a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, you can call us at our number 309-807-2427. But better yet, go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com, and you can make a donation there, and it'll tell you how to do it, and it'll tell you more about ourselves also. I'm here with my wife, Lynn, today, and she's going to have a few words to say before we start into the abortion article. I think she wants to make some comments along that line. And we're going to have a great show for you today. So at this point, I'll turn it over to you, Lynn.
Okay. Isn't this weather wonderful? This is my kind of weather. And when we get the first frost, all the molds and spores and everything will die off, and it'll be even better. Can't beat it with a stick, as they used to say. Also, we've had a wonderful week. We weren't with you last weekend because my daughter and her husband and her son came up from Texas. We were going to celebrate. We celebrated birthdays this week. We have six birthdays that fall within a week of each other in September. So fortunately, most of us got together to celebrate. They were here from Texas. My grandson from Maine was here with his wife and his daughter. And my daughter's sister-in-law, who had a birthday too, she was here. We had a wonderful visit. It was great. Now, Bob's going to talk about abortion. And it's appropriate at this time of the year because next month, October, is the month where we have Respect for Life Month. So, Bob, you want to take it away and get into
I sure will, yes.
You got a lot of material there.
We sure did have a good time over the weekend. And the weather, again, was, you know, turned out nice, and it's beautiful now. And this is my favorite time of year, too, Lynn. It's dry usually, and like you say, it's warm during the day and cool at night. It's just nice weather to be out. So I mean, maybe the young kids and everything like the hot weather for swimming in the summertime, but this is great weather, I think, for everybody. People want to go out for camping or fishing or whatever at this time of year. Almost anything they do, great time to be on a golf course.
Yeah, but flowers are dying off. Still getting tomatoes, but very, very slow. They've really slowed down to almost nothing.
At any rate, we're going to take the article from one or two articles from the symposium in First Things magazine here and talk about it. The introduction to the symposium is called Roe Must Fall, and there are articles there by Robert P. George, Michael Stokes Paulson, Daryl E. Paul, Yuval Levin, and Mary Eberstadt. And I'll get into more of that as we go along, who these people are and what they do. But the editor of First Things, R.R. Reno, introduces it, and he says, since the Supreme Court decided Roe versus Wade in 1973, more than 60 million Americans have been killed. Their blood cries out from the ground for justice. Ours is a God of mercy, not retribution. But let us not test his patience. Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, currently pending before the Supreme Court and expected to be heard in the 2021 to 2022 term, leaves no room for half measures. And it's going to be in December. It's coming up here, actually, and so it'll be in 2021. It poses a direct challenge to our abortion regime. Nearly 50 years after Roe, the court must reverse this lawless and death-dealing decision. So that's what's at stake. And the issue is Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Organization. And what the Mississippi law calls for is it calls for prohibiting abortions after 15 weeks. And I think there may be a few very, very tiny exceptions to that, but that is pretty strict. Limiting the abortions after 15 weeks. And so you can see what that is going to do. On the one hand, you have Roe versus Wade in 1973. And then in 1992, you had the issue of Casey. And in Casey, the court ruled that abortions can be performed all the way up until viability. Well, 15 weeks is certainly long before, you know, viability. So it would be going against the Roe law. On the other hand, a lot of the conservative justices on the Supreme Court insist that states have a right to pass laws like these. And they're in a position in which no matter, you know, what they rule, if they rule in favor of Mississippi, then they have to rule against Casey, which takes most of Roe with it. So this is the issue at the time. And if they don't rule against this, there isn't any place they have left to stand. Then they have been on record talking about how Roe versus Wade and Casey are unconstitutional, which of course they are. I mean, if you've ever read them, it's so convoluted, it's incredible. And we'll get a little bit more into that. But they're in a position where no matter what they do, if they try to leave things as they are, it will be simply based on nothing. And they will be violating their very, very, you know, all of the things they believe in and talk about. If they don't base the case on originalism, they'll be violating the very interpretation of the Constitution that they say they profess. So there are a lot of people who are saying that they're probably going to, more likely than not, rule against Roe. And Roe could very well be gone. And this article here by Robert George is titled, Roe Will Go. And Robert George is a McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and Director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. And here's what he says. He says, let me offer a prediction free of any face-saving hedge. Next year, the Supreme Court will hold that there is no constitutional right to elective abortions. And when he says next year, actually, it could be this year because the case is going to be heard in December. In Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Organization, a case pending before the court, it will return the issue to the states for the first time in 49 years. It will do so explicitly, calling out by name and in reversing in full the two major cases that confected and then entrenched a constitutional right to elective abortion. Roe versus Wade, 1973, and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 1992. And this man, Robert George, predicts the vote will be 6-3. I also read in the Catholic Register where they, Gerald Bradley, a law professor at Notre Dame University, predicted that Roe will be overturned more likely than not. And he says it will be overturned by a 5-4 decision. So there are some pretty big guns here in law saying that Roe is going to be overturned, and they're giving the margin by which they think it will happen. And so George goes on here, Robert B. George, and he says, why do I think so, that Roe will be overturned? I have no inside information. I know most of the justices, but I would never ask what they intend to do in a case, and I'm sure none of them would tell me if I did. But it's widely thought, and I myself believe, that 6 of the justices believe Roe and Casey to be grossly unfaithful to the Constitution and also unjust. No one will want to extend those precedents. The question observers debate is whether some of the 6 might prefer merely to chip away at those procedures. The reasons for this gradualist approach would be to avoid making the court seem politically motivated and to avoid drawing the court further into political fights by, for example, empowering a push for court packing. Never mind that Dobbs may be the best chance the court ever gets to fully reverse Roe and Casey. Forget, too, that it took decades to get a court like this. Years for a case this clear to work its way up to the legal system, and 9 months for the court to decide to take it. Apart from all that, a halfway ruling in Dobbs, one that upholds Mississippi's law but stops short of overruling Roe and Casey, would not avoid politicization. Indeed, it would backfire spectacularly, and it would not be worth the cost. All this follows from 4 points that are clear to anyone who has spent time with this case and with the broader issue of abortion's legal status, hence my prediction. First, if politicization means making the court seem driven by politics rather than law, Roe and Casey are the ultimate causes of politicization. And having this court stick by those precedents, when as seen below they are squarely at issue, would only heighten the impression that the court is doing politics and it's not doing law. For the public knows that the court is majority originalist, and that originalism cannot be squared with Roe and Casey. So if the court maintained those precedents against a head-on challenge, no one in the nation would doubt that it had been done for fear of the political fallout. And this signal that the court is susceptible to political blackmail would only deepen the problem. Second, though either cases might have left room to uphold an abortion regulation without fully overruling Roe and Casey or resorting to made-up rationales, this case does not. Any such ruling would have to rest on reasoning that was groundless, vague, or entrenching of some sort of abortion right. It would either exacerbate the court's reputation for politicized decision-making, multiply its forays into the political war zone, or extend damage done to our legal and political order by Roe and Casey's survival. Third, developments this summer make it clear that a failure to overturn Roe and Casey outright would do more than increase those precedents' immediate harms. It would shatter the conservatives' legal movement. Scores of filing in Dobbs suggest that the conservative legal movement now sees this case as the ultimate test of this court's position on reversing Roe, which is in turn the ultimate test of the court's commitment to constitutionalism and proper law. Anything less than reversal of Roe would be a wholesale defeat for the conservative legal movement. It would put wind into the sails of critics who have in recent years claimed that the conservative legal establishment is faking a commitment to restoring the courts to principled constitutional reasoning and is really only interested in securing judgeships for its cronies. So a ruling along those lines would make the court look bad either way, and maybe worse if it rules in favor of Roe. And it goes on, and the disillusionment would be understandable. The court would have invented a coy and legally groundless half-answer to the most important constitutional question of our time. When that question was squarely presented to the court and not honestly avoidable, the justices would have done so against their own professed legal philosophy in order to placate progressive elites, or out of fear of them. Everyone on the left and right alike would know it. So these are some important things that will be really working in favor of abolishing Roe. Fourth, even if a halfway option in Dobbs could help the court preserve political capital, as it cannot, doing so would still be pointless. The only reason to preserve capital is to spend it on cases in which the rule of law requires a hard decision and the stakes are high. Well, the stakes are nowhere higher than with Roe and Casey, and no two cases are more disruptive of the rule of law. Refusing to spend capital to overturn them would be like refusing to apply to college because the application fee would have to come from your college savings account. So it's not very likely that these people have any kind of openings to do anything except to rule against Roe. And if they don't, it's going to be just a huge hypocrisy that is going to make them look as if somehow or another they're just politicizing everything, or that they're actually afraid of the pushback and the furor on the left. And so they're retreating from everything they believe in because they're cowardly. So they're really in a position where it is very, very likely that they might and probably will overturn Roe. We're going to stop here and take a break and come back to this most important issue of our time. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Dr. Ray Guarendi is coming to Bloomington, Illinois. This psychologist, speaker, author, and host of TV and radio programs will be at Eastland Suites in Bloomington on Thursday, October 7th. This special evening event includes a cash bar, silent auction, buffet, and Dr. Ray's presentation. You can even sit at his table. It's a fun night that you won't want to miss. Make reservations by September 27th. Details at CatholicSpiritRadio.com or call Carolyn 309-830-4164.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break, and we have been talking about the abortion issue, and that issue is coming up, of course, in December. And the issue will be over the Mississippi law that prohibits abortion after 15 weeks. And so we were talking about four essential points that would cause the court to rule in behalf of the pro-life situation and rule out Roe, and also rule out Casey as well. So this is, you know, what we're talking about. And as my wife just said here before we came back on the air, it has not looked so good for the pro-life cause in a long, long time. And the article goes on. It says, a timid decision in Dobbs would be a grave loss for the rule of law, the most grievous loss since Roe itself. It would shatter the wider movement built over 40 years for replacing the exercise of raw judicial will with principled constitutional reasoning. It would forfeit the best chance we may ever get to reverse Roe and restore the ability to protect unborn children from lethal violence. untold numbers of innocents would die in order to bring the howls of outrage at Dobbs a few decibels lower than they would be otherwise. And what he's talking about here is any ruling whatsoever is going to have to restrict abortion in some way. And if that happens, the pro-abortion people will be screaming and yelling. And about the only thing that a lesser decision, a timid decision, would do is maybe put that down a decibel or two in volume. So there really isn't much to gain for the Supreme Court by doing it. And it goes on. It says, Roe invented a constitutional entitlement to elective abortions effectively at all stages. It forbade virtually all abortion regulations in the first trimester and allowed only those serving the mother's health, not protecting the fetal life, in the second. While it purported to permit prohibitions in the third trimester, it required exceptions for health, which a companion case, Doe versus Bolton, defined so broadly as to include emotional, psychological, and familial health considerations. This guaranteed a virtually unlimited right to abortion up to birth. In other words, that exception for health was expanded so much that it became a hole in which you could fly a 747 through. So it really, there was no restriction on abortion. The Constitution defines no right to elective abortion, much less one this sweeping. And the precedent cited by Roe, even the most lawless ones, did not come close to supporting a right to any activity so harmful to innocent third parties. Roe leaned instead on lies about the history of our common law and lies about the history of state abortion statutes. It sourced them to two articles by a single writer on legal history, a former general counsel to the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, later known and now known as the National Abortion Rights Action League, now as NARAL, Pro-Choice America. Can you imagine that this case turned on a couple of writings by one person purporting to interpret the history of our, you know, abortion laws? And this was accepted and went over. It said one article was so recent that no actual scholar had been able to examine its sources, and so flawed that it was said to fudge the history by counsel for Jane Roe, who cited it only because an internal memorandum put it helped preserve the guise of impartial scholarship while advancing the proper ideological goals. Once scrutinized, the writer's sources crumbled, as did Roe's historical claims, as shown in multiple scholarly refutations. But by then, of course, it was too late. Indeed, for the next several decades, Roe's failure as a piece of legal reasoning became a point of near consensus, even in the liberal legal academy. Eminent legal scholar, dean of Stanford Law School, and avowed supporter of legal abortion, John Hart Ely, wrote that Roe was not constitutional law and gave almost no appearance of an obligation to even try to be constitutional law. So there is somebody on the liberal side who was honest enough to recognize that the ruling was based on nothing that we find in the Constitution. Harvard's Lawrence Tribe, the preeminent liberal constitutional scholar of his generation, wrote that behind Roe's own verbal smokescreen, the substantive judgment on which it rests is nowhere to be found. And as Edward Lazarus, a former law clerk to Roe's author, would go on to admit, for decades, no one produced a convincing defense of Roe on its own terms. So when the court revised Roe and Casey, with three new justices appointed by Republicans, many thought Roe would go. and even when the court declined to reverse Roe, it could not bring itself to affirm the case wholesale. Embarrassed by Roe's groundless trimester framework, the pivotal justices replaced it with a rule barring undue burdens on abortion before fetal viability. And that's what's at stake here, because Mississippi is banning, it's prohibiting abortion after 15 weeks. And that is, of course, before viability. And so if they rule in favor of Mississippi, they have to rule against Casey. And they can't not rule in favor of Mississippi because they're committed to the idea that states have a right to restrict abortion. And it goes on here. It says, and even that rule, Casey refused to defend by traditional legal arguments or traditional criteria for adhering to precedents. And what I'm saying here is that the court did not base Roe or Casey on real legal arguments at all. They avoided it and came in with various things that they made up on their own. Instead, Casey declared that the right to have one's unborn child dismembered or soaked in a saline solution is essential to preserve the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life, because beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state. And if anyone can understand that or has any idea what it has to do to the Constitution, I'd like to see them come forward and explain it to us. I mean, the whole thing was made up by Justice Kennedy, has nothing to do with the Constitution, and sounds more like some kind of channeling going on by Shirley MacLaine. And Casey explained that it was hearing to Roe because admitting Roe's mistakes in the face of widespread criticisms would have undermined the court's credibility. I mean, have you gotten that? That if they ruled that this law was stupid, this law was silly, this law was based on nothing in the Constitution, this law was made up by all kinds of smoke, such as the one put out by the Justice Kennedy, somehow or another, if they ruled that, then the court would lose its credibility, and so they have to keep Roe going. In other words, we have to keep on having abortions of millions and millions of babies just because the Supreme Court justices in 1973 decided that they can't overrule it because it would make the court of 19, or I mean the justices of 1992, I'm sorry, can't overrule it because they would make the court of 1973 look bad. I mean, this is... Yeah, it makes no sense whatsoever that an abortion law based on erroneous, in effect, illegal, interpretations of the Constitution or no interpretation at all somehow has to be kept in place. Otherwise, the court, that wouldn't be credible. This is totally crazy. Then to add insult to intellectual and moral injury, the Casey court ordered the nation to quit its squabbling about abortion, already calling the contending sides of national controversy to accept a common mandate rooted in the Constitution as read by who? Well, the Casey Court, in other words, by us. They're saying the people in the United States should stop squabbling because this is the ruling that we gave, made up by ourselves, and why doesn't everybody just shut up? And this is from the Supreme Court, and to say that somehow overruling this would ruin the credibility of the court is totally laughable. If the credibility hadn't been ruined already, it'll never be ruined. Then, in their legal, moral, and rhetorical enormity, Roe and Casey are rivaled only by Dred Scott versus Sanford, which declared that black people are incapable of citizenship, and also Plessy versus Ferguson, which blessed state-imposed racial segregation. That is the quality of precedent at stake in Dobbs. The precedent some preposterously claim the court must leave intact to remain credible as an institution of law and raw, not raw politics. But imagine that. Here you had this horrible ruling in the Dred Scott case, you know, by the Taney court at that time. And that ruling, of course, was overruled later after the Civil War with the 14th Amendment. So blacks were guaranteed the due process, of law, and that their life, liberty, and property could not be taken away without due process of law, and that they had rights the same as everybody else, and they could be citizens of a country the same as everybody else. If they do not rule Roe out, in effect, they're saying that the ruling against Dred Scott was wrong. And somehow or another, if they were back at that time, they would be ruling in favor of Dred Scott, because they would be saying, we can't rule against Dred Scott because it might make the court look bad. I mean, this is where they're at. So if this ruling doesn't go that way, there is really going to be an uproar. It said, though the points above are reasons to take any fair opportunity to reverse Roe and Casey, they are consistent with a belief that it's wisest to reverse Roe and Casey piecemeal over several cases. But in Dobbs, that incrementalist approach isn't possible. There's no honest reading of Casey under which Mississippi law would stand. That's because the law prohibits abortions starting well before viability, where Casey held that before viability, the state's interests are not strong enough to support a prohibition of abortion. So they're caught in a bind. They're committed to ruling states' rights in a law like the one in Mississippi. But if they do it, in effect, just by saying that Mississippi's law is legal, they're overruling Casey. So they're in a situation where it would be best to just say the whole precedent for all of this was wrong in the first place, and that Roe versus Wade and Casey decisions simply don't stand and never did. It goes on, and to avoid eliminating any remaining right to abortion, it would need to replace Casey's doctrine with another. It would need to allow prohibitions to start sometime after conception, but before 15 weeks. Yet the drawing of any such line would find no support in any legal text, history, or precedent, leaving nothing for the justices to cite in support. An arbitrary line would have to be drawn, and it would look and be legislative and hence political. It would be very clear that it was so, that they were making it up. And a deliberately vague one, while looking less arbitrary, would invite endless relitigation. So if they try to be vague about all of this and somehow get out that way, they know that it would invite endless relitigation of its exact implication. And there's another problem. As Sharif Gurgis summarized it in a widely circulated letter on the obstacles to any of 13 possible halfway approaches to Dobbs, to create a new and narrower right based on a new and more permissive test would require the justices to justify the new right and test in their own voice, which would make it hard for them to say in a future case that there is, after all, no such right. So in other words, they would be making up something themselves, an entire change in the Constitution, and making it impossible for something to be overturned in the future, which, of course, that they have sort of put out as along a line that perhaps they can get rid of Roe piecemeal, or over time. So that would be ruled out by them, and it would be ruled out by them in their own voice, making up all kinds of stuff to try and justify what's going on now. So they would be rejecting not only Roe and Casey, but their own affirmative reasoning in Dobbs. So if the court wanted to make true progress against Roe and Casey without looking political, reversing those precedents would be its only viable option. Otherwise, they're going, in trying not to look political, they're going to be political, and they're going to definitely look political. If some had hoped for a modest ruling when the court decided in May to take Dobbs, the ground has shifted beneath them. In July, Mississippi filed a brief dedicated almost entirely to arguing for a full reversal of Roe and Casey. That call was then echoed by more than 70% of the amicus briefs filed in support of Mississippi or of neither party. By figures and institutions, including half the states, more than half of Congress, hundreds of state lawmakers, hundreds of scholars, and scores of organizations from around the nation. If indeed fully one-fifth of the briefs, including one that I filed with John Finnis of Oxford, went further, calling on the court to recognize that the Constitution not only allows but requires states to prohibit elective abortions. So these justices have been reminded by hundreds and hundreds of briefs sent to them exactly what the stakes are and exactly the fact that Roe and Casey are not constitutional law. So we're going to stop here and take a break. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Dr. Ray Guarendi is coming to Bloomington, Illinois. The psychologist, speaker, author, and host of TV and radio programs will be at Eastland Suites in Bloomington on Thursday, October 7th. This special evening event includes a cash bar, silent auction, buffet, and Dr. Ray's presentation. You can even sit at his table. It's a fun night that you won't want to miss. Make reservations by September 27th. Details at CatholicSpiritRadio.com or call Carolyn 309-830-4164.
Join in this special rosary event, America Needs Fatima, Public Square Rosary. This annual event will be held on Saturday, October 16th at 11:45 a.m. Over 20,000 prayer rallies will be happening across the country. Bring your family and friends of all ages. The location is across from Holy Trinity Church in Bloomington at the corner of Center and Chestnut. For details, check out anf.org or call Sandy at 309-662-1717.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break, and we have been talking about the abortion issue, and that issue is coming up, of course, in December, and the issue will be over the Mississippi law that prohibits abortion after 15 weeks, and so we were talking about four essential points that would cause the court to rule in behalf of the pro-life situation and rule out Roe and also rule out Casey as well. So this is, you know, what we're talking about. The article goes on. It says that the conservative legal movement, the movement for constitutionalist judging, has come to see Dobbs as the ultimate test of this court's position on a constitutional right to abortion and the ultimate test of this court's and the conservative legal movement's commitment to principal constitutional interpretation. So it is revolving around that. It doesn't seem that this court can somehow or another avoid in any way either ruling against Roe and ruling against Casey or putting their own constitutional beliefs, which they have proclaimed, in jeopardy and making themselves, in effect, really a laughingstock. So I'm hoping that, you know, this is the case, is that, you know, that they will definitely understand and see that, and they won't be intimidated by the blowback that they know will be coming after their ruling. Against this backdrop, a decision upholding Mississippi law without overruling Roe wouldn't be seen as progress. It would be seen as a betrayal of constitutionalism nearly as acute as outright reaffirmation of Roe. It would signal the decisive failure of an effort of more than 40 years to restore constitutional judging and constitutional law. It would fracture the conservative legal movement and shatter along with it any remaining faith in the Chief Justice's ideal of judges as umpires calling balls and strikes. And it would make them simply a legislative body, legislating the law as they see fit and ignoring the Constitution. The ranks of those expecting judges to advance their political aims would then swell, and also with conservatives. I mean, the best I can put this, it would seem to me that a ruling somehow or another, no matter what they twist themselves into, favoring things as they stand or slightly modified, would in effect put the court like referees in a basketball game, and everybody on both sides would expect them to be calling decisions, you know, either way. And if they simply were always calling fouls against one side and never calling fouls against another, there would be a huge uproar by the other team and all of its adherents. So this is what would be going on. And they would, in effect, you might as well say, we don't need Congress or anything else. We have the constitutional body that from now on will govern us and legislate for us. That seems to be what would happen if they somehow find some goofy way to not overrule Roe and Casey.
Would have to be a goofy way. The whole law is goofy.
Yes, it is. And if anything you have to say on that, you want to say, you can go ahead and say it any time. We're near the end of the article here. And afterwards, we'll talk a little bit about, you know, some of the wrongness, radical wrongness of Roe. We're talking here mostly about the legalities and some of the radical wrongness, but not really the why Roe should be overturned simply because of the moral wrongness.
Right, right. It's against God's law, the natural law.
Yes, it is. It's against God's law, and it's against any kind of sensible law, and it's certainly against the Constitution. It says Roe figures centrally in the judicial anti-canon, the cases by which you test the soundness of your theory of constitutional interpretation, and not vice versa. If your theory says Roe is right, then so much the worse for your theory. You know, this is according to the Constitution. In other words, it's ruled out by the Constitution. If your movement cannot reverse it, so much the worse for your movement. And if you can't spend capital to reverse it, then your capital is worthless in the first place. So when an opportunity to reverse Roe and Casey is squarely presented, and alternative paths to upholding an abortion law are lawless or would only entrench some right to elective abortion, refusing to reverse Roe and Casey is self-defeating. If it is not obvious that Roe and Casey should now be reversed in full and explicitly, then the conservative legal movement has already failed. As I write, as I'm reading, George says, as I write and you read, unborn children are being slain. As a practical matter, Roe and Casey must be reversed for any of these children can enjoy the full protection of the law. And isn't that exactly what the 14th Amendment says? The 14th Amendment says that everybody is entitled to due process of law before their life, liberty, or property can be taken away from them. And it seems as if the unborn were totally excluded from this right, that the ruling actually used the 14th Amendment to justify abortion, and it did this by pretending that there was only the woman and the abortionist. And somehow or another, what the abortionist was going to abort was totally ignored, that there was no third party here. This is how the law went. I mean, even in early England's laws under Blackstone, abortion was ruled out. It was considered that life in the womb had to be considered, and the law had to be applied to it. In the early part of our country, even during British rule and then slightly thereafter, pirates in this country often had women who were part of their crew. Really, this often happened, especially down in the Caribbean, with Blackbeard and other pirates down in that area. These pirates were captured in some cases, and they were sentenced to be hung. But the women, in some cases, who were pregnant, the hanging had to be delayed until the baby was born because of the interpretation of our Constitution along the lines of Blackstone. The babies had to have rights. And yet Roe was done as if there was no existence of anything else. Any other party, it somehow or another was just between the woman and the abortionist. And crazily enough, and just outrageously enough, the 14th Amendment was applied to the woman alone, and it was used in effect then to justify abortion. In other words, to deny the right of the protection of the law to the unborn children. It was no different whatsoever than denying blacks the right to the protection of the law in consideration of their life, liberty, and property. And it was restored after the Civil War. The 14th Amendment was put in there to restore that right. And certainly we need to do the same thing now. And the justices certainly ought to see that the restoration of due process of law should be given to the children who are alive but yet unborn. They're part of.
That's the key right there.
Yes, it is.
They're alive. They are individual human beings, but they aren't born yet.
Exactly. And some of them, it's.
You can't deny that they're alive.
Exactly. And they need to be taken in consideration. It's as simple as that. And they used to be and always were. And Roe was done by pretending the 14th Amendment didn't really exist in the way that it was actually written, and using it, horribly, just using it against its own intentions in order to justify abortion, when instead it should have been used to prohibit abortion. This is the kind of pretzels that the court had to bend themselves into to get this law in the first place. And it's the kind of pretzels they will have to bend themselves into if somehow or another they try to preserve it. So it's just that strong. It says, I'm going on here. Abortion will not end overnight. Some states will continue to permit the procedure until the court acknowledges that the unborn possess the right to life. Even women who live in states that prohibit the procedure will be free to cross state lines. But we know that even modest obstacles save lives. The denial of federal funding for elective abortions is estimated to save some 60,000 unborn children each year. And that will happen, because if Roe versus Wade goes federally, certainly the federal government will not be able to fund abortions, against their own law. That will be up to the states. And when that happens, there will be a lot of children saved. And the fact is that the Constitution, the laws of the Constitution, always overshadow, and they draw the states' laws case by case and bit by bit over to their side. The constitutional laws always prevail. The Constitution of the United States, the federal Constitution, always acts like a magnet to pull all laws in accordance with it. And I can't go into the explanation of this, but it does happen. And in fact, it's inevitable. And over time, all these other laws will be nibbled away at, and the pro-life movement will gain tremendous power and tremendous progress. So this is a really, really important decision. And it says, again, it will save 60,000 children a year. So let's be frank. There is a cost to delay, and that cost comes in innocent lives. That is yet another reason to expect the only defensible outcome, next year, the Supreme Court will reverse Roe and Casey. And again, it really won't be next year. Well, it could be, but I don't know when the case will be heard in December or how long it will take. But the fact is it will start here in December. And people out in the audience listening should know that it's the most important issue and decision of our time, just like the Dred Scott and Sanford decision was the most important decision of its time and generated actually the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment should be protecting unborn life, not somehow making it possible to abort unborn life. So we're going to end this article here, and there are some other things we can talk about, the radical wrongness of Roe. Before we start into any of that, I'll just turn it over to you, Lynn. Is there anything further you want to say along these lines?
I think it's pretty clear. I think we'll find out probably next June 22, how the court will rule. We need to be praying. This is very, very important. You know, a country, as Mother Teresa said, a country that kills its young kills itself, something to that effect.
Yes, we will talk about that maybe next week. We'll go into the law. But the fact is, the overturn of Roe, if we have the confusion and the chaos that we have in our country today because our law is being distorted and it expands further and further into other issues and other things, a lot of that will end with Roe versus Wade. You can't have a huge principle, one of the greatest principles of all time, to be distorted and not expect it to affect a lot of other things along the line, and it has. And it's divided our country along this issue. And once you get it divided along this issue, it creates a political divide along other issues. And that divide expands and expands. And that is what is happening today. And I think the overruling of this Roe would start restoring sanity to our laws. And maybe, and we can't get into right now, but maybe but next week we can point out how what at first seems to be a disaster for a lot of people and what at first seems to be something that would be terrible for a young girl or young woman pregnant and afraid and so forth will ultimately turn out to be something good for the entire country and will be a means of bringing us back together again and at the same time a means for restoring our law to what it really should be. So the ruling, it might cause a huge controversy at first, but as people start talking it out and it starts happening in practical application in only a few states, people will begin to see that it's not a disaster. There are other alternatives to helping women besides allowing them to have an abortion, and that it's something that can bring us together again, and at the same time a problem that can be solved, and it can be solved in such a way that all people can feel good about it. So there are going to be a lot of positive things if Roe is overturned, and I hope the court thinks about those. And the turmoil that it causes at first will direct energy towards solving those problems. So a lot of good could come out of this decision.
Sure could. You might stop the decline in the country, because I think this is one of the basic reasons why we are in such a decline. You know, the having no respect for life, it's so obvious. You can see what's going on around you. The disrespect for anything that has to do with life is very obvious. And once this is settled, and if they abolish it, I think we'll get back on track to thinking differently, and maybe the country will cohese again. Otherwise, there's going to be no country.
Exactly. In Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court created a constitutional right of some human beings to kill other human beings, and that is causing a tremendous amount of turmoil in our country. And there are ways in which we can overcome that, as Lynn was saying. And in doing it, it's an issue that actually can make us come together again, because there is some good things on the side of the liberals in the idea that there needs to be help for mothers in trouble. And certainly the pro-life movement understands that, but it's been caught up so much with simply opposing Roe that it has not been able to advocate the things that needed to be done and the things that it can say yes to. And this will give a chance for both sides to say yes to all kinds of solutions to a lot of the problems of unwanted pregnancy, or, you know, women who are in situations in which they feel lost and alone. There's a way we can come together to overcome that. And the pro-life movement has always been for those things, but it has never really had an opportunity to advocate them, because Roe takes up so much of its time, and in saying no, that it hasn't been able to say yes to the things that most people in this country would like to hear. And that's what it will enable this decision, if it goes against Roe, will enable us to do. So we're going to stop here, and we'll come back on this subject again next week. We'll talk a little bit more about those kinds of things. What are the pro, the yes kind of things that the pro-life can do, and how can it join up with the other side in doing it? And how can we start to come together again by actually attacking a problem in an entirely different way, a positive way instead of a negative way? So we'll talk about that then. In the meantime, Saint Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.